Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today we're listening to part two of M.M. Phelps' account of the Battle of Tsushima. And he tells the story of the epic voyage of Imperial Russia's Second Pacific Fleet, as it travelled 18,000 miles from Russia around the Cape of Good Hope to take part in that battle.
Before I say anything else, let me say that the battle itself was almost one of anticlimax, because it lasted an unconscionably brief period because of the superiority, for various reasons which will rapidly become apparent, of the Japanese side. I'll get that over with right at the start. But before I do anything, one of the comments, or several of the comments that I received at the close of the last meeting concerned the fact that a lot of people would like to have seen more of other vessels that could have been involved in the action, scenes at Port Arthur itself, and some of the weapons, etc., which could have been, which would have been involved in it, or similar types. Now, not all of this sort of photographic material is available. In fact, it's damn near impossible to get. So, if you'll bear with me on this, what I have done is to assemble a collection of photographs typical to the period, and which have been assembled from various navies, all of which are within that same period. As a matter of fact, the general designs are almost identical. So, if I could have the lights killed in the first slide, please, Kate. I'm starting out more or less with the development of the large weaponry. Now, what you can see here, I've started out with, is literally the king-size, outsize, and muzzle loaders. This one is a 15-inch muzzle-loading Rodman gun from the Civil War. It fired a 900-pound shell to a range of only about 3.5 miles. I've included it simply because it's virtually the last giant development of the muzzle-loading weapon and is typical of that which would have been used at sea, except that the barrel would have been much longer because of the greater ranges over unimpeded territory, namely water. And, of course, you don't need the howitzer effect. But that is pretty much typical of the type of gun you would have seen at the close of the period immediately prior to the pre-dreadnought. Now, here we are at Port Arthur itself. We see here a Japanese artillery spotting team lining up. Action has already been commenced. And you can see several light field pieces in the bottom foreground. The Japanese didn't have too much heavy stuff there actually mobile in the field. It was generally of about 2.75-inch caliber and would equate to a light field gun. The territory, as you can see, was pretty open, and as you can see from the elevation of the weapons here, the range was, well, pretty extreme. And here we see one of the same light field pieces being manhandled into position. The size of the wheels is noteworthy, and this is to enable the piece to travel over very rough ground. It is in fact a breech loader, and the size of the wheels actually gives a misleading idea of the size of the weapon, because the average Japanese soldier of the time was only about 5'4". But they were wiry little so-and-sos, and they managed to do an astoundingly good job. Next, please. Now, this is an 11-inch howitzer. This particular weapon was one of the principal weapons concerned in the siege of Port Arthur. It fired an almighty shell for its time, about 1,000 pounds. Range was very, very good. And in this particular instance, the Japanese led the field, because they gave Alfred von Krupp and his merry men in Essen some ideas as to how to develop heavy howitzers. They were the Japanese were the first to use this type of heavy breech-loading howitzer, and it was these weapons which not only reduced the port of Port Arthur, but in fact sank several of the Russian ships in harbour, up to and including battleships. Their lobbing power was quite fantastic. You can see also in the foreground here, ready-use ammunition. The whole thing was actually on a barbette carriage. There was no recoil mechanism as such. The gun slid back on its carriage and slid back by force of gravity, was pivoted at the breech end and swung around on a circular track on a pivot arrangement by a crank. Next please, go. Now, at the Russian earthworks, we see a similar type of arrangement, only this is elevated. This is the Russian reply. The calibre's 10-inch. On the left you can see an observation post, and it looks like things must have been pretty furry around there because at least a 6-inch brick's gone through it. There is no comment came with the picture as to what happened to the observer up there. Knowing the Russians, I'll bet you anything you like, it wasn't an officer. The firing steps there are pretty extreme. You can see one chap there by the right-hand breech of the gun. Don't know what he's doing, but in the foreground, an interesting little article, see a bit of smoke there. Well, that's rising from a samovar. The average Russian pongo wouldn't travel anywhere without his kappa. Only thing is he did it in a slightly different fashion to the British counterpart. And on the right here you can see a set of steps leading up to the parapet and over. Next please, Kev. Now, here is part of the massive Russian earthworks. These guns, which are 10-inch, are once again on barbette carriages. As I said before, they slide back on recoil. There's no recoil mechanism as such. And it's interesting to note that this was possibly taken after the capture of the port, because there are no breech blocks in the guns. Blocks are open. There's also a lot of ready-use ammo standing around. There's another carriage here, shells here, some of them standing on their noses. Here is the Travis handle. Elevation was at the gun itself, and you have some observers up here, as you can see. Next, please. Now, this is a scene from the actual battle. Now, you may think these carriages are the same as what went before. They're not. They're Moncrief disappearing carriages, which were manufactured all over the world in various guises. Moncrief was the original patentee. He was British. Then, of course, Armstrong's got in on the act. They made him as well. And the best of the lot didn't actually appear until the late 20s in the States. And it was made by a firm called Buffington Crozier from a design developed by one General Buffington. But the whole idea of this piece is that there is a very definite recoil mechanism here. The gun, when it fires, swings back on a pivot, swings straight down, and disappears from view after all recoil. When it's in the lower position, it fastens there, and the piece is loaded, obviously by hand and trolley, and then it is released, and the hydropneumatic mechanism raises the whole piece up to steer its nose over the parapet, at which case it fires again, and the whole cycle is repeated. As you can see, things are a little bit furry there as well. Next, Kurt. Here is part of a detachment of a Japanese Guards Division. Not one of them is smiling. I think they take the whole business very seriously, which they did. It's interesting to note that the siege of Port Arthur was notable for the first use of the Maxim gun, predecessor of the Vickers, in open trench warfare. It was, funnily enough, it was the Russians who used it with absolutely devastating effect. They cut the Japanese down like flies. There were a lot of German and British observers present. The British didn't think too much of the idea. They thought it was rather unsporting, but the Germans took it very, very much to heart, and the lessons were learned about 10 years later. Their rifles were Arisakas, 6.5 calibre, and their bayonets were, oddly enough, of a British pattern. Their uniforms were dark blue. They didn't change to khaki until later in the piece. Next, please, Kip. Rather unique scene, this. Ammo didn't come ready-made from the factory in these days. They actually filled it in the field in a tent by means of a funnel. Now, I can't see any no-smoking regs around, but I understand, judging from some of the accounts I've read, that there were some rather horrific results from the odd Russian brick landed in that lot, because the powder just came out in loose kegs. It was a brown, what they call brown powder or cocoa powder, which was nothing more or less than a derivative of black powder at that stage. They didn't switch over to nitrocellulose until later in the war. Next, please, good. Here are some Russian, Japanese sailors actually on board the Makasa. They look just about the same as any other jet tower in their early time, except once again, they don't think they appreciate having their photograph taken. If anyone knows what this is in the foreground, I'd like to know, because I don't know. Next, please. Now, this is the launching of a pre-dreadnought battleship. As you can see, they were launched pretty much complete with even the stacks up, and on this occasion they rigged a donkey boiler up to a whistle so she could see if she could salute her own launching, which she did. The dots down the side are not scuttles like the Oriana. I think they're simply nothing more or less than jarred rivet patches all the way down, but you can see from this the standard fashion of the day, with the so-called military mast, which is a rather conical structure with fighting tops all the way up. Ram bow, of course, pierced in the side for casement guns, and the bones, bare bones of the bridge structure is already up. That pretty sharp accidentally was taken at William Cramp's yard at Philadelphia in the United States. Next, please, Kip. Here is a 12-inch gun being fitted into position on a ship of that class. You can see the wooden plug still in the breech. Breech is not in position. Measuring marks here. Quite a sophisticated turret design for the period. It's a flat and inclined face, which didn't come in until about 1904. And everyone worked in bowler hats or derbies. Very formal. Next, please, Kurt. Now, here's the battleship Mississippi being fitted out. I've put her in because she's typical of the day and gives you a fair idea of the size. And she only went about 12,000 tons, which means you could hoist the whole lot on board hood and not even notice the difference. Once again, you can see that flat-faced turret. She is about a year from completion at that point. See from the size of the men aboard that she's not particularly large. Next, please, sir. Full power on trials. They, at this particular stage, that particular ship was doing about 19 knots. There wasn't any such thing as telescopic lenses for the Thornton Picard camera in those days, so the poor Joe who took it was actually in the boat for the standard lens. And the caption that came with that photograph is that the chap who took it very nearly lost his life about 5 seconds later because he was damn near swamped. If the bow wave didn't get in, the suction curve down the hull would have, because they didn't have much idea, really, of hull form then. And once you get past the bow wave, then you strike that almighty dip down the hull as the suction effect comes in. If any of you were lucky enough to see last night's programme on the rise of the Red Navy, and to see the suction wave created by a nuclear on the surface, it's unreal. Coal, of course, and they're shoveling like maniacs down below. Next, kid. Here's another one. Once again, she's really belting it out there, although I think the stokers must have had the word put into them because there isn't much of a haze there for the period. She's got most of her guns aboard, but she's still doing builder's trials. You can't see it there, but it is identifiable in the original photograph. That battleship, by the way, is in Nebraska. But they make an impressive sight, believe me. Well, I think you'd agree with me. Next, please, Kip. Here's a pre-dreadnought out of the water. As a matter of fact, she's in a floating dock. What strikes you immediately is the colossal draft of those ships. Fully half her physical vertical hull divisions. You have bilge keels there for once, and the pious hope that they'll stop your rolling. They didn't. Twin funnels up top, which is an inheritance of the British Majestics. Beautiful scrollwork, white hull, and everyone rowing round her down below there, once again wearing the inevitable derby. But they're quite magnificent ships. My heaven, they could eat coal. Next, kid. Where it all happens is where the sweat's really raised, about 150 degrees. Usually, by this stage, they were water tube boilers, usually of a Belleville, Nicklaus pattern. They're usually about anything between 18 and 24. The total complement of any given ship at the time, you could bet your socks that between a third and a half of, or at least a third of the complement would be taken up merely of stokers. They used to chew an almighty amount of coal. There was no such thing as mechanical firing. It was all doing it with the banjo. And, as I say, temperatures were about 150 Fahrenheit down there. Next. That is one of the main engines of an early protected cruiser. Now, you may think, of course it's steam, but you say, where's the engine? Well, actually, it's a triple expansion engine on its side. There were two of them. You're looking at, there's the big ends down here. They were like this because of the height of a triple expansion engine would not permit the protective deck to go over the top and still not have the top protruding through the whole gubbin. So they, until they refined things a bit, they put everything on its side. Next to it. Once again, by this time they'd gone vertical. Everything beautifully clean. This was photos courtesy of the United States Navy. This is a triple expansion engine once again. But as you can see, you didn't have enough room to swing a cap down there. Next, please. And that's where it all came out. That's three of the four funnels on a Russian cruiser. And, they're pretty tall. You can see from the size of the steps how high the funnels were. As a matter of fact, it was pretty much de rigueur in these days to have stacks of 100 feet high. Now that's 100 feet, not from the deck to the funnel caps, but from the boilers to the funnel caps. And most people, when you think of 100 foot stacks, you think, well, from the deck up. Well, it's not. It's from the boilers. Nick? Typical of the time, an open bridge. And I mean open. No such thing as covers, armor plate, or anything else. And if the safety valve lets go, you get deafened. It's right behind you. Conning tower immediately beneath, armoured at least a foot thick and slotted. But even so, a remarkable number of people used to get killed there because flying stuff would come straight through the slot. It's interesting here to note, by the way, that the cowls, ventilating cowls, are turned up. You'd think they'd be turned forward. Must be even too much for those below. Next, please. Wireless. When Rozhdestvensky went to sea, that was about all he had. Photograph was taken about 1904, and the range of that, the huge accumulators and the dot and carry method, wasn't much more than about 50 miles, so it was only good for the modern day equivalent of WT between ships at sea, and that's about it. Next, please. Now, this is a 5.4 inch casement of gun. Typical of the time, this one's a French pattern. Pattern of 1884. Once again, you can see with the way that it pivots. It does have a recoiling action there, hydropneumatic, and was loaded, laid, and fired by hand. Next, please, Kip. Twin 8-inch. Everything done by hand. Local control, no director, no automatic loading, and you get it and grab it and heft it in yourself. And those bricks are about 200 pounds. Rate of fire, about 2.5 per minute. I know it sounds 2.5, but doing it on an aggregate. Once again, it was all manual, sponge out, everything else. But they did have a reasonably respectable range of times, about 7 miles accurate. Next, please. Loading by hand, a 7.1 inch gun. The bloke in the centre is actually hoisting that shell in on his own, and God help your fingers, because there wasn't a loading tray. You just slammed it in, put your fist up, and hoped that the bloke who was swinging the lever to close it wasn't too quick, or you'd lose it. Powder was loose, or rather in bags, not cartridges. Once again, rate of about 2 rounds a minute. Next, please, Jeff. Typical of the time, a 14-inch underwater torpedo tube mount on a ball going out the side of the hull. Now, this sounds all very well until you remember that you've got a big stick sticking out the side of the hull, and there'd be a considerable amount of force being exerted to swing that sideways. So what they did after a while, they'd swing out a shield first, or slay out a shield to actually protect the tube. And of course, this wasn't only to think of the torpedo tube itself, but also the fish, because early in the piece when they didn't do this, they had some rather nasty accidents. So he's belting along at about 15 knots, they say fire one. Of course he fires one, the only thing is, when as soon as it's halfway out the tube, it starts to bend. You have the horrible thing of getting a mechanical enema by way of your own tubes. Guaranteed to upset a fine day's steaming. That's only, I'd say, a 14-inch, but the biggest of the day was about 18. Next, please. Gatling guns. They were still standard fare all over the world. The Russians used them a lot in fighting tops. The Japanese didn't use them that much. That one is a .45 caliber and could chat out about 800 rounds a minute, cranking for all your worth. Accuracy was quite good too. They usually carry those in fighting tops or in wings of bridges. Next, please, Kev. This is a one-pounder Schroeder gun, laid and fired by hand like a ruddy great big rifle. Once again, it was a crank open a tiny bit, load the shell, and then swing it yourself, because you didn't have any such thing as mechanical traverse or anything like that. By the way, there was no recoil mechanism, so you just have to hope the mount was strong enough or you'd end up in the drink. Next, please, Jim. Protected cruiser of the day. This was one that was manufactured by the United States but actually ended up in Japanese hands, but long after Tsushima. Very slim, quite fast for a day, so you could do about 21 knots butt out. The same fast as the old Minneapolis. But not really big, as you can judge by the chap in the bows. It's interesting to note, by the way, here, that you do have provision for a bow torpedo tube, which we usually, after a while of fruitless experimentation, papered over, because if the fish failed, you'd run over it. Also, even though you've got horsepipe here, the anchors are still not being, stoppers anchors are not universal at this stage, and so you still found on most ships the anchors being catted, in other words, hauled up by a catted and placed in special recesses in the deck. Or sometimes you'd even find ships with both, a stoppers anchor up the pipes, and at least one bower anchor being catted in the old fashion. Things, old ideas die hard. Next, please. A typical destroyer of the sort you would find in Rostrovinsky's navy, and which made an 18,000-mile voyage around the world. Complement about 70, would you believe? At least half of those would be stokers. Only about one or two 12-pounders, if that, usually one or three pounders. A couple of 18-inch tubes, and they'd be good for about 25 knots. They were like cockle shells, and they were absolute hell to work in, and at that stage of the game people weren't being paid hard lying money. By the way, they didn't have too much concern for harbour pollution either in those days. Next, please, Jeff. And if you come alongside too fast and try and be a smarty to impress the Admiral, that's what happens. If you wear the warp, next thing you know you have a first class court of inquiry as to why. But they are very soft, and you'll notice she concertinaed almost very, very neatly. This particular one actually made it home on her own. Looks like the CO's got a couple of his sons up top having butchers as well. Next, please, Kip. Rostrovinsky set off around the world with mainly battle wagons, but he was sent after him another squadron, which I'll mention later. Two of which were coast defense battleships, which were totally unsuited for an ocean voyage, but which nevertheless made it. Now, they had horrendously low freeboard. As you can see from here, a bloke standing on a boat, streaking up to reach the bulwarks once he got past the break in the port and so forth. So, in anything but dead calm seas, they were very wet. Next, please. And this is the ship that started the design revolution. This is the Redoutable, built in France about 1870, about 10,000 tons. No turrets, she was what's known as a central battery ship.
You can hear the main battery located here. Big sponson with two guns per side, or usually three, two either end and one going directly at beam. The enormous cutaway here on the side was to allow fore and aft fire. The ram bow is extreme, as you can see. She was actually
a notable vessel insofar as she was the first vessel in the world to be built, or first battleship in the world to be built almost entirely of steel. And she had an absolutely remarkable draft of something like 28 feet, and she could knock out about 15 knots with a clean bottom, everyone shoveling like blazes. Next, please. This is what the design developed into, and from which the Russians notably made great use of. This is the French battleship Gloire.
Note again the great tumble home here, as separated in the last photograph. The still vestiges of the central battery ship. Armament was Colvin, four forward, four aft. This became pretty well standard until the close of the King Edward the Seventh battleship era. Beautiful design tunnels, until that pagoda style. Beauty. With an early form of smoke buckling on it. Once again, the military style now, the French waiting for that in a big way. They also, you had very, very short post holes. And here, now you see a stock of anchor.
Next, please, Kip. And that's it for the time being there. So now you see the sort of ships and armament which would have contested the battle at Tsushima. And now I think I'll get into more or less the formal part of things. At 22:30 hours on the 8th of February 1904, units of the Japanese Navy under the command of Admiral Hiroshi Togo attacked without warning the anchored warships of the Russian Pacific Fleet in their own base at Port Arthur. This attack, which was a severe moral as well as physical blow, put the battleship Repsan and Tsarevich on the bottom and severely damaged the protected cruiser Pallada. Other naval forays made almost simultaneously resulted in the damage or destruction of further Russian vessels, and the cumulative effect of these successes was to virtually neutralize the effectiveness of the Russian Pacific Fleet and to awaken the great powers, including Russia herself, that perhaps Nippon might be a power to be reckoned with in the future. And that actually came to pass some 15 months later. And on the 20th of June 1904, the Tsar convened and presided over a meeting of the Higher Naval Board at St. Petersburg. The reinforcement of the Pacific Fleet, which had been decimated, had become a matter of urgent necessity, and the subject of meeting was to choose the officer best suited to command the relief force, henceforth to be called the 2nd Pacific Squadron. The man finally chosen, excuse me, Chris, next slide please. Yes? Yeah. Good. Next slide, please. Ah, yes, well, I think we've gone a little bit out of skewing here. This is at Port Arthur itself. As you can see, there's the Repsan on the left and the Pobieda on the right. I don't know which ship this is in the foreground. Next, please. There's the Pallada on the left, and the Pobieda, also on the bottom, with some kibitzers, who are always around when a photograph's being taken. Next, please. Right. Next, please, good. And here is the hole through the Pallada. A lot of people said that there wasn't much damage done, but that torpedo hole really put her on the bottom. Next, please, good. Here we have the general locale of the area where the Russian fleet was based, at Tallinn, which was in those days known as the Val. They had to come all the way down here, through the Canadian out, through the English Channel, before they could get even halfway on their way. Next, please, kids. And here is where they have to get to.
Hello there. Oh, sorry. Right there. And Tsushima Island, the island where the donkey is there, between Korea and the home island.
Thank you. Next, please, Kip.
To get there, they have to come round here, through, round the Cape of Good Hope, up here, to the state of Singapore, up to there. 18,000 miles.
A lot of people reckon he wouldn't do it. Next, please, Kip. And here's the man who chose to lead it. Rostovensky himself. The man finally chosen was 54-year-old Admiral Zinovy Petrovich Rostovensky. Born an aristocrat, this fiery, precise disciplinarian entered the Navy as a 17-year-old cadet. His passion for gunnery led to his enrollment in the Artillery Academy, from whence he passed with special distinction. And it was not long before his skills were put to the test in the Russo-Turkish War. His reckless bravery didn't kill him, but a monumental falsehood perpetrated by his commanding officer very nearly brought his promising career to an abrupt halt. The captain, one Baranov, claimed that his command, which was the small arms beam of the Vesta, sank a vastly superior Turkish ironclad, when in fact the Vesta had gone about and fled upon sighting a Turkish vessel. Now, being a subordinate, Rostovensky kept silent, albeit with a rather bad conscience. But after the war, the Turkish admiral, Hobart Pasha, revealed the truth in a letter to a Russian newspaper. And without thinking, or without even consulting Baranov, Rostovensky confirmed the story in a letter to the same newspaper. Now, that sort of thing is just not on. Whether you're right or wrong, it's not exactly a wise thing to drop your own admiral in the soup. Usually has rather nasty consequences. And he did it without any attempt to justify either Baranov or himself. But his luck held out. Baranov was cashiered. And by a miracle, Rostovensky survived. And he not only survived, but he was even promoted. Something which astounded everyone, including Rostovensky himself. Now, his next task was that of reorganizing the gunnery branch of the Bulgarian Navy, which didn't take him long. And in 1885, he was appointed naval attaché in London, where it appears he was both respected and well-liked. In 1894, he received his captaincy, and as commander of Admiral Agatsiev's flagship in the Far East, was thus in a good position to observe the behavior of the combatants during the Sino-Japanese War. He returned to St. Petersburg as commander of the gunnery practice squadron of the Baltic Fleet, and it was during this period that Rostovensky's career received its greatest boost. At 1000 hours on the 24th of June 1902, Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany arrived at Revel Roadstead aboard the Imperial yacht Hohenzollern. Now, I had a photograph of the Hohenzollern, and like a fool, I lost it last night, and I still can't find it, so apologies. On the Hohenzollern, accompanied by two German warships for a state visit. And steaming with them was a Russian cruiser and the beautiful, next shot please, Kev, immaculate yacht, the Standart. That's the Tsar's little pushback. Beautiful ship. The vessels whose lines were emulated by the designers of the British Royal Yacht, next please, the Victoria and Albert. Now, not many people know that, but the bloke, I think it was Watts who designed the Albert, the Victoria and Albert. He got his ideas from the Standart, but the V&A wasn't that much of a success. For instance, they made a mistake when designing her, and almost immediately upon launching, she turned turtle. Queen Victoria never liked it. She usually used the Enchantress. And from the time she was built to the end of her days, the V&A went about with over 500 tons of concrete in the bottom to keep her upright. And who on this day, well, the Standart, carried the host, Tsar Nicholas II. After the mind-warping thunder and smoke of the simultaneous 31-gun salutes had passed, the royal parties and their staff lunched aboard the Standart. And following this lavish repast, which lasted until 1500, all persons present changed into more serviceable uniforms and boarded the cruiser Minnan to witness at sea a three-hour gunnery demonstration by selected battleships and other picked units of the Russian fleet. The excellence of this demonstration, with its steady, extremely accurate fire from all vessels, greatly impressed the Kaiser. He publicly commended Rostovensky in the presence of the Tsar and his own Admiral von Tirpitz. And such praise from a monarch of a country noted for gunnery excellence did not go unnoticed, and in rapid succession, Rostovensky was promoted to Rear Admiral, made Chief of the Naval Staff, and at the same time ADC to the Tsar. Now, charged with the task of assembling the 2nd Pacific Squadron, next please, Dick. Thank you, leave it like that. Rostovensky descended on the grass-ridden and labyrinthine warren of the Naval Victualling and Purchasing Department like the Seven Plagues of Egypt. And within 3 months, this one-man cyclone had succeeded in making himself the most unpopular officer in the Admiralty. The rusty, corrupt machinery had not seen the oil of a forceful personality for many a year, and Rostovensky worked 18 hours a day in order that his fleet might be made ready in the shortest possible time, and that its needs would be fulfilled. Every conceivable item needed by a fleet on its long voyage of war had to be obtained virtually at the rush. shells and propellant of all calibers, mines, belts of Maxim gun ammunition, torpedoes, scuttling charges, if needed, charts for all vessels, engine room and auxiliary machinery spares, all had to be found. Even such items as office equipment and reams of various forms and even toilet paper were procured and placed aboard the fighting vessels and transports of this rapidly burgeoning fleet. And because of the varying latitudes through which the ships would pass, provision had to be made for extra clothing for the men as well as their food. And that included salt meat, which was delivered by the barrel load, tins of butter, boxes of biscuits and dehydrated vegetables for soup making, salt preservatives, and last but not least, hundreds upon hundreds of crates of vodka and a good quality champagne for the officers, whose accommodation and comfort were attended to extremely assiduously in the Tsarist Navy. They had the happy habit of, if things weren't exactly to the officers' taste, of adding things on an ad hoc basis to the construction of ships, which usually resulted in them being extremely top-heavy and having very poor steering characteristics. Now, Rostovensky's recurrent nightmare was coal. He knew from experience that the boilers and engines of certain units were not very efficient, and that the likelihood of their being overhauled prior to departure was remote, and this meant very high daily fuel consumption. Two light cruisers in particular, the Jemchug and the Izumrud, each burned 21 tons of coal per hour at 90% power. The colonial navies of Great Britain, France and Germany possessed vast networks of coaling stations in all parts of the world, and Japan could be sure of access to British coaling facilities should the need ever arise. But this wasn't the luck of Russia, whose supplies were virtually restricted to her own waters and ports. And yet, in spite of all this, Rostovensky proposed an 18,000-mile voyage with an entire fleet around the Cape of Good Hope to the coast of China. Well, it was thought to be impossible, but not to Rostovensky, who personally entered into a contract with the Hamburg America Line for that company to supply the entire 2nd Pacific Squadron with coal from a vast fleet train of 60 colliers spread around the world from the Baltic to the Yellow Sea. The estimate of coal required reached the truly colossal figure of approximately 500,000 tons. And even the British expressed astonishment, and they didn't think the Russians could do it. The day of departure from Kronstadt arrived. July 15 was the expected sailing date. However, Rostovensky's problems seemingly defied resolution, and so this date was abandoned. One of the main problems was the shortage of qualified personnel, the cream of which was in the Far East with the hamstrung original Pacific fleet. Competent specialist officers were also in short supply, the engineering branch in particular being so affected. Rostovensky corrected the numerical shortage situation among his ratings by accepting into the ranks reservists, poor quality conscripts, and as many merchant seamen as he could get. But this solution brought its own problems, as many of these were useless without adequate retraining, and the remainder contained a large revolutionary element. Now, at this time, it's worth remembering that social reform in Russia, or the agitation for same, had been going on for about 30-odd years. Many of the Tsar's own relatives had been killed by assassination and bomb plots,